Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Bloodstream Podcast. My name is Patrick James Lynch, and you are listening to a Bloodstream Live from Friday, May 22nd, with special guest, licensed professional counselor, Debbie De La Riva. As Mental Health Awareness Month drew to a close, and as the Pain Podcast from Bloodstream Media also drew to a close, we invited Debbie on to discuss mental health when it comes to chronic pain. She offers some great insights, cites data from compelling studies, and even walks us through a little meditation, which we'll do here at the tail end of the podcast. Amy Board, the host of the Ask the Expert podcast and mental health segment contributor for Bloodstream, joined me for the discussion with Debbie. It's worth mentioning that when you wrap up here, National Hemophilia Foundation's CEO Len Valentino is Amy's guest on the current episode of the Ask the Expert podcast. This following Hemophilia Federation of America's CEO Sharon Meyer's two-part appearance last month. So once your mental is all healthed and your ears are in need of just a little more, head on over to bloodstreamexpert.com or follow the links to Ask the Expert on bloodstreammedia.com. Finally, this episode of the Bloodstream Podcast would not be possible without the ongoing support of Bloodstream's presenting sponsor, Takeda. To learn more about Takeda's commitment to the bleeding disorders community and their response to COVID-19, have you heard of it? Visit bleedingdisorders.com. Now, please enjoy this mental health and chronic pain live conversation streamed via Bloodstream Media's Facebook page on Friday, May 22nd, with special guest, licensed counselor, and Mental Health Matters 2 founder, Debbie De La Riva. Hello and welcome to the Bloodstream Podcast live on May 22nd, 2020. My name is Patrick James Lynch and I am joined today by Ask the Expert host, Bloodstream Podcast contributor, Believes Director of Outreach. What else should we say about you, Amy Board? Hello, Amy.
Hello. I'll just add Denver Bronco fan. I'll add that.
And recent Last Dance like enthusiast. I had no idea that the mug's going down. Wow.
Let me tell you something. I remember as a teenager, you know, we were a huge sports family. So we weren't, you know, we lived in Denver. We weren't Chicago fans per se, but my dad grew up in Chicago and you can't not, it's like the Patriots. You can't not follow that dynasty that they had. I loved Scottie Pippen. And so it's been so fun to watch because A, it's well done. And B, I didn't know half the stuff and it's great.
Awesome. Yeah. Scottie Pippen, huh? Why Scottie?
Because I like the secondary guys. I've always liked the guys that weren't the big deal, but the ones that like, if you didn't have them, like you wouldn't be great. So
yeah,
loved Jerry Rice. I loved Ed McCaffrey in Denver. Those were always my guys. The second guys were always my favorite. And so Scottie Pippen was such a dear soul. He was such a dear, you know, Michael Jordan had this, you know, he was great too. I mean, he had this like bravado and things, but Scottie was great.
I'm glad you said Michael Jordan was great too. Just to clarify for anyone who may have not been sure that Scottie is talented, but Michael, he's pretty great too. I was a Rodman guy. I liked the weirdos because I gravitated toward the countercultural figures when I was a kid going to an all boys like Catholic school and with a very strict way of viewing the world. But then when I heard like Howard Stern and George Carlin and Dennis Rodman, and I was like, who are these people? Why are they saying stuff I like? This is interesting. So I liked Rodman and his just like, I'm living my life my own way, but I'm phenomenal at what I do. So I can. I thought that was just the best. I will say the more I've gotten to learn about him, the less impressed I am with Dennis Rodman, to be honest, but as a kid, I really enjoyed him. This has nothing to do with why we're here. We're here because it is Mental Health Awareness Month. And for regular listeners of the Bloodstream Podcast, you'll know Debbie De La Riva. She contributes to us quite often. If you're active within the bleeding disorders community, you will also likely know of Debbie. She has been, I don't know, everywhere in the last number of years, spreading the good word about taking care of our mental health in addition to our physical health. So we wanted to bring Debbie on today to just share a few ideas and maybe guide us through a quick meditation before all is said and done. So with that, let me remove this logo and instead present the actual living human person. Please welcome Debbie De La Riva to the program. Hi, Debbie.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going well. How are you doing?
Good. I'm just enjoying your chat with Amy. See where that was going to go.
It could possibly not end. So we had to call it at some point.
I'm actually glad that you made the transition because I was about to ask you some more things about Dennis Rodman. So I was like, professionalism, this is great. We could have gone 20 minutes on that.
I don't always have that level of professionalism, but today I do. Because Debbie, you're here and this is important. And I just, before we start, want to read from the Mental Health Matters 2 website your biography quickly for those who aren't as familiar. Debbie De La Riva received a master's degree in counseling psychology from the University of Houston and became a licensed professional counselor in 1989. Her work experiences have included serving as a stress management therapist in a psychiatric hospital, managing a mental health resource department, and was an executive director of an affiliate of Mental Health America. When her son was born with severe hemophilia in 1994, the entire De La Riva family quickly became involved with the bleeding disorders community on a local and national level. Debbie is former executive director of the Lone Star chapter of the National Hemophilia Foundation, past co-chair of NHF's annual meeting, and a recipient of the Ricky Ray Award for her advocacy efforts. Her son Jorge attended hemophilia camp, ultimately became a camp counselor, and has the same birthday as I do. That's not in her bio, I threw that in. Her daughter Christina was elected to be a member of NHF's National Youth Leadership Institute, and her husband Jorge served as chairman of NHF's board of directors. In addition to founding Mental Health Matters 2, Debbie is a certified mental health first aid instructor and provides training to hemophilia treatment centers and chapters around the country. Debbie, nice work.
I kind of summed it up, I guess.
What first interested you, you know, just to kind of get into it a little bit. You first received your degree in 1989. What inspired you back then to pursue this? Why did this grab your interest?
You know, I have a theory that I know has not been proven in any way, but people who have maybe not like the best childhoods are many times drawn to go study psychology. And I swear it's because we're trying to figure out what just happened to us and maybe even get a better outcome by knowing more. Now that is completely my opinion only.
Well, I think there's something to be said for the role of developmental trauma inspiring people as adults to take agency and empowerment over their experiences as a child. And then in better understanding my own experiences, I do have something to offer others. So I think there's something to what I think your theory may have more to support it than perhaps you're letting on. I want to start by talking a bit about chronic pain. As you, I think, are aware, we just concluded 6 episodes of our first season of what we call the Pain Podcast.
Right.
And chronic pain was a big part of it. And while that wasn't specific to hemophilia or bleeding disorders, there's so much in my experience and in the work that I've done, shared life experience when it comes to living with chronic pain, whether it's as a result of hemophilia or sickle cell anemia or a really terrible injury that didn't heal properly. When you think about chronic pain and our mental health in particular, what comes to mind for you?
Yeah, well, first of all, I want to start off by just telling you or giving you a compliment that maybe a lot of people are thinking, just they haven't given it to you yet, because what you're doing here is giving voice to a lot of people that feel maybe forgotten about in our community. You're validating their pain and you're letting them know, everyone, that it's real, and just finally giving people a place and a platform to talk about it. I've noticed that our older generation, they're beginning to come back again to national conferences. Because I see that finally, what they've said to me is that finally there's something more than that one pain session that goes on. So I just want to say you're part of that positive solution. So pretty cool stuff.
Well, thank you for that. I appreciate that. So what do you think about that? When it comes to chronic pain, what comes to mind for you?
The word that comes up to me is risk, or even high risk, because it has been proven over and over again that this very succinct intersection between chronic pain and depression and anxiety. People, sometimes they talk about it as a prisoner of pain. And I've done a lot of research on how much pain there is in our community, at least the physical pain, and then just began to really understand that tie between that and being at high risk for mental illnesses like substance abuse and pain and depression, anxiety. There's something called a cycle of depression and pain, and I don't know if you've heard about it. I know I sent you that link the other day.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't know if this is where you want me to dive into it, but I'll be happy to do so.
Sure, please do.
So what they've come up with, and they've known this for a long time, Patrick, it's just amazing to me, kind of that separation we've had from the science and what we hear about, or what should be common knowledge, really. But if you think about the relationship between pain and depression, it's really clear. Maybe I could even put it up or something just to give people an idea of these two circles, right? Imagine one circle is the vicious psychological part of it, the cycle, and also the physiological part of pain. It's really easy to figure out how physical pain can just have this compound effect where you feel pain, you're not likely to do the exercise that caused the pain. It goes into, you know, your body just kind of not having that physical fitness to it. And then the next time you try that activity again, you're real sensitive that the pain's going to happen, or it does. Therefore, you stop again with doing the physical activity. That would help the pain in the beginning. People get this, right?
The makes sense. This whole it's logical.
Thing. Yeah. Yeah. But the thing that people don't realize is the psychological part of pain is that, you know, I know for me, well, first of all, I want to say that I feel really humbled. And maybe even inadequate about talking about the hemophilia pain, because I know that I don't understand it, I don't feel it. So I'm about to compare it to some pain that I feel, but I need to let you know that I know that it doesn't touch the pain that a lot of our guys and gals feel. But when you have the physiological pain, you're angry and you're exhausted and you're impatient with people. And then it just really affects your moods. And when your moods go down, relationships can become problematic. People don't want to hang out with you. You're just less tolerant. And lack of sleep comes a lot with pain, too. And that has a lot of physiological responses. But I've always tried to figure out, what is the deal with depression? We now know that when you're depressed, you're more sensitive to pain. In fact, the more depressed you are, the higher you perceive your pain. And I couldn't figure that connection out either. Is that something have you heard of before? You've heard about?
Well, I'm not sure if this is correct, but the idea of pain amplification. So something that I've gotten curious about is how pain can both be a symptom of depression, and it can be something that causes depression. And so there's a little bit of a chicken and the egg in terms of, and I think you could make an argument like, at what point are we is it a semantics conversation? But in my experience, what I have found is it's really important for me to understand the underlying cause and not necessarily just focus on the symptom. So this idea of pain amplification, that depression can, you use the word, increase my perception of pain. I believe I experienced that. And I'm not certain if pain amplification is the right term, but I think it may be.
So I've dove more into this too. And it really goes back to this whole cognitive behavioral thing, that what they say is that people develop this negative idea about their own pain that just exacerbates how they deal with it in general. I mean, I know for me, it's really easy to get in that helplessness, right? And that hopelessness and the why me.
Sure.
Yeah. And also this pain can bring on this negative belief too about yourself. I'm defective, not good enough. Who would want to hang out with me? And then one of the things I've been learning as I hang around the conferences and talk to guys about their pain, many of them have told me like this worldview they have, like nobody really cares about them anymore, or they get so angry when they see people laughing at conferences and they're having a great time. And they're just having a hard time getting from one session to another. It just gets ingrained in everything that goes on, you know?
Debbie, what do you think, or what do you know from your work, that this time period, this quarantine stay-at-home time period, how has that perhaps exacerbated people's experience with pain and then the kind of spiral that can generate from pain?
Yeah, I think any time that you get some limitations placed on yourself, I just call it high-risk time, because when you think about pain, too, it has a lot to do with control. And when we are faced with a pandemic, this loss of control of outside of our windows, I think it just exacerbates that idea of the lack of control you're feeling over your pain is one thing. The other thing it does is just it really makes it hard to socialize, and it's so much easier to feel isolated. you know, talking to you and Amy, I love being with you guys, but it's just not the same thing talking to you on this computer screen as it is sitting next to you and feeling your vibe and, you know, just being with you. I don't feel as connected.
Do you find yourself getting antsier or more? Is it getting harder to tolerate the isolation of this time or not for you personally?
For me, it's because of the nature of what I do, Patrick and Amy knows, is this that, so what's always been important to me and why I've been so committed to the community or been involved is I had to have a sense of purpose. My life had to have some kind of meaning, right? And so I dove into mental health. And since I've done that, Patrick, I'm busier than I ever have been. Mental health is just flying off. They're like pancakes flying off the trays, you know? So I developed this this webinar called Maintaining Your Mental Health in Uncertain Times. And I did it in the very beginning and presented that all over the nation. And I have more webinars to come.
Can people see that online?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's available on one of the different websites of the 8 chapters that I've done the presentation on. Also, HFA has been a big sponsor of them. So it's on their website as well.
Debbie, I know that we've talked in the past, and you and Amy have talked on the podcast about various tools. And it occurs to me when we are talking about restrictions during this time that puts a limitation on certain tools. I maybe can't go on that hike at the state park that would typically be a great way to clear my head, for example. Mm-hmm. But meditation is a tool that isn't affected necessarily by the time that we're living in. And there's been some interesting research done on the effectiveness of meditation in managing pain. Can you speak a little bit to that?
Yeah, before I start, as you know, I'm just real, right? I'll tell you about my fear of talking about meditation and chronic pain. I think I told Amy I was at one NHF conference. A gentleman came out very angry from a session on chronic pain and arthritis, hemophilia. And I can't say the words, I don't think I'm here, but he said, if I sit through one more session about meditation and pain, I'm going to do something really bad. And he was angry. I can feel it. I can see his veins right now. And I said, you know, I'll never do that, especially never on Facebook Live during a pandemic. I'll never talk about that again. that's just stupid. But then as things line up in the universe, the guy that's the person that actually designed a whole mindfulness program, he based it on his initial work with chronic pain patients back in the 70s. When you hear about mindfulness-based stress reduction, that's this gentleman, this researcher from University of Massachusetts, John Kabat-Zinn, and he developed it. It's called mindful-based stress reduction. And so the work that he had a long time ago in the 70s has been replicated hundreds of times, or maybe even thousands of times in research. Because what that gentleman, I think where he was at is where I would be too, is like, who are you to tell me that just because I check out of my brain for a little bit, check out from reality, my pain's going to go away? That's ridiculous. And he's right. It doesn't take the pain away. But what it does is calm the entire stress response system down to a tolerable level. And so you can think clearer. So you can have some degree of respite and some degree of focus. Because pain is a lot about the controllable. And what meditation is all about is breathing and being intentional with your focus. And that in and of itself lets you know that you do have some degree of your body and that free radical anxiety we're feeling every day during the pandemic.
Debbie, that being said, what did you think that gentleman that day was responding to? Why was he walking out of that room so angry? Where is that coming from? Because I'm sure he's not alone in that.
Yeah. I wish I had the courage to approach him right after that, but I really think it had to do with frustration, one thing. Number two, think about our conferences. Think about all the signs you see in the exhibition halls. Oh, you know, we're so great with hemophilia. I'm so glad I have it. You could do anything you want to be. And I just think those messages, too, could feel really invalidating to people who have watched their family members suffer through HIV or hep C or chronic pain. So I could kind of see why you'd have that frustration. Of course, I'm just projecting a lot of this onto him.
No, but that's fair.
And plus, if I were to tell you, Patrick, that if you were to take a 10-week program, and I know you've worked on meditation in the past, so you do this 10-week program and you work on this, you're going to feel better. And really, I'm kind of telling you that it's your fault that you're in pain. It is in another message. I don't know. Maybe I'm taking that too far, but.
No, I don't think so. I think when talking about perception of pain and things that can amplify it, it's also easier for it to sound like, oh, you're just saying it's all in my head. Is my pain not real?
That's what I was thinking.
It can sound dismissible. So it's something about working on the pain podcast that I've really come to appreciate is how nuanced some of this is and the importance of language, really, and just making sure we're using the right words and really listening to people, but also not being afraid of what is scientifically been supported through studies and data, because this is, it's, you know, I had an Alexander Technique teacher back in my acting school days who would never let us talk about the mind and the body as different things, because it's, I don't know if you guys know this, it's one thing. And she would also give me some grief because when I would talk about my ankle, my left ankle in particular, my original target joint, I would often say the ankle.
Oh, wow.
Say, that's your ankle. It's my ankle. It's part of you. And when she would encourage me in that direction, very often there would be an emotional response from, and actually I remember one time working with her where she was able to help me find a range of motion. And I did a squat unlike I'd ever done before without my ankles coming up off the ground. And I just started crying. I didn't know, I certainly didn't think like, I'm going to cry about this, but I got down to the squat and it was just like, bah! I just, something came out. So I think the interconnectedness of the pain, what's happening in our mind, what's happening physically within our body, what's happening within our nervous system. These are all real biochemical things that have a role to play. And, you know, when you mentioned that the frustration, and I think I've had this in the past with meditation specifically too, is I'll get to a point, I don't historically seek help until I need a lot of it. And by that point, the things
like that everybody might, else.
And by that point, the things that might take 5, 10, 15% of the edge off enough that I could become functional. You were sort of speaking to that a little while ago, Debbie. Yeah. By the time I'm seeking help, that's not enough anymore. Mm-hmm. So if it was recommended to me, well, why don't you meditate? That may have helped me earlier when the ability to calm myself to a state where that 5, 10% edge would be enough, but I wait too long. And then I'm having to respond to something more akin to a crisis rather than proactively noting, oh, here's some symptoms, here are some things going on with me. Let me grab a tool such as meditation or journaling or something to just not let that 5 to 10% get away from me. Let me try to cut into it in a significant way before it gets to be too much. So that's a long-winded way of saying, I think sometimes frustration and dismissal of certain tools or approaches is born out of wanting a fix-all, wanting a, you know, pop a pill and it's done, or okay, I can do stretches for 2 weeks and then I'm great. And it's like, it really doesn't work that way. Unfortunately, it just doesn't work that way. So there's a mindset shift too that feels important for people kind of stuck in that frustrated place with pain.
No, I agree with you. And that's why I want to talk as much as I can about this to people, because it's not just a mindset too. It's actually about education about your brain and how it works. And it's really when I figured that stress response out, or to the point that I can't, I'm not a researcher, but to where it made sense to me, that's when it really helped me with my depression and complicated grief. Because I realized that there's two phases of stress, right? You have all this stimulus that goes in, it goes straight to your fear center, and then it tells your body to react so you can get in a safe place or you can fight off what's happening.
Right.
And so people get that. That's that startle thing. But what people don't understand is that the second part of it is the place that we have control over, because we do have some control between that fear and the whole bodily responses. Because what happens after that fear base is that it actually goes to the front part of your brain to think about how you want to respond to this.
That executive.
That's where it actually process. Yeah, the executive piece. That's where we have the time. I mean, the ability to slow down long enough and figure out how we want to respond to this pain or this person yelling at us, or whatever it's causing.
Yeah, it's having that ability to just pause for a moment. I've found effective for me literally the practice of counting Mississippis. So if I get internal, do you do that too?
No, sorry, dude. Don't do that.
No, that's good. You know, I just understand things all. But I have found that if I'm getting worked up and I can tell, like, this is the next thing I say, unless addressed, will not be wonderful, then literally in my head, I kind of power through other thoughts and just think consciously one Mississippi, two Mississippi, three. And I generally don't need to get past five, but it's just like, it's almost like a freight train that's just running through whatever else is going, ba-bing, ba-bing, bing, 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 bing. And it just, I railroad the Mississippi train through and just calm everybody down. And it gives me just
that
enough time.
So nice.
Yeah, it's it felt really silly. And I eventually like mentioned to my therapist that like, I've been doing this for a couple of months and it's really helping. And now I'm like less shy about sharing it because it's been really helpful.
Actually, it's the thing I love about you the most is how authentic you are. So cool. But
for better and for worse.
And, you know, there's a lot of research too. A lot of people say, I don't want to take the pill. I can do this. I can wheel this through. Antidepressants have been shown not just to help moods, but really to help chronic pain too. Because it's those same chemicals that's involved with depression and the same neural highway that that the antidepressants work on. What people don't realize is if we stay in that chronic sense of toxic stress, we actually develop these neural pathways to the fear center and going back to the response center. They actually get solidified, neurons that wire together is really true. And my antidepressants just help me slow down enough, not be so reactive, so I can create some new pathways.
And to the point about those pathways, Debbie, is that where we get that term neuroplasticity? Is as a result of when we just keep having the same pathways firing, we sort of almost carve out a certain response system in our brains? Is that an accurate way of kind of understanding neuroplasticity?
Exactly. We have a certain way to respond either because of our genetics or how our brains are structured. And then with the structure itself is our input and how we react. If we react the same way, it actually does become a solid sense of neuron fibers wired together. There was a study on ladies that were caring for the children. They were both in the same amount of stress, but they did some kind of psychological intervention. I don't remember what it was. They actually saw that not only the changes happen in their brain, happen on a molecular basis too. Their telomeres, the part that increases your lifespan or not, actually had an impact where they had, it was more quality and quantity.
Wait, what's the thing that increases your lifespan? I don't know about this. What is that?
Oh, telomeres. Telomeres are on a molecular basis where you can measure, it's on your DNA, and you can measure about how long your life expectancy could be.
What?
And chronic stress. Yeah, I promise you, I'll send you the study. And we have seen that if we really get control over our stress, that people live longer. Because
I mean, like, of course, but amazing that we can actually sort of take a peek at that.
I will totally send that to you.
Yeah, I'm like not able to go for the rest of Friday if you don't. Wow.
But neuroplasticity, that's where the hope is. We really can calm our mind down enough so we're not getting our hearts to pump out and getting our lungs to pump out all of this energy that just circulates in our body and turns to fat and cholesterol and high blood pressure.
Debbie, I would love to, in a little bit, have you actually lead us through a short meditation. I think that could be really helpful. But before we get to that, you mentioned, you know, you talked about that fella earlier at that meeting, and obviously that's kind of stuck with me, and your commitment to the bleeding disorders community in particular. What kind of research is out there about pain in our community in particular? What do we know about pain within bleeding disorders that might be particularly important to keep in mind for our community, if anything?
Oh my goodness. So there's a lot of information about pain in our community. What I did is I became a member of a WFH so I could get access to, well, I wanted to support the cause and I wanted to get access to the Journal of Hemophilia. And that's how anybody can do so. And there's hundreds of studies on chronic pain. I'm going to cite one of them, but I want to be really careful with your audience because there's so many nuances to quoting research. If you just change an adjective, it really can be misleading. So I want to be careful. But one of them that anyone can access to, it's called an assessment of pain function impairment, anxiety and depression for people with hemophilia. And it was in January 2018. What they did, they took about 381 gentlemen with hemophilia, mainly hemophilia B. So what that means too, there was a less percentage of those that had inhibitors. But even with that group, Patrick, they found, they asked how many people are, you know, in pain in the day of the comprehensive visits. 76% of them said that they had pain that day. 14% of them said it was severe. And then asked in the last, you know, 4 weeks, how much pain do you have? Again, 90% of them. These are gentlemen with a median age of 34, right? And 24%
right
of them
smack
said,
in
yeah.
my age. Great. This is my group. Okay, I'm listening.
This is your group. Well, 24% of you said that you're in your pain would be considered severe in the past 4 weeks. And then it goes on to talk about mobility issues. 61% of the gentlemen were feeling like they had mobility issues that day. 53% affecting your usual care, you know. But in the last 4 weeks, the numbers really go up to like 79%. Bending, it's really interesting you said bending. 79% of them said in the last 4 weeks they felt a certain degree of pain, severe degree of pain when they're bending and walking and climbing. Then it gets into the depression is so interesting. They said that 43% of them were feeling depressed on the day of their comps, right? But
so that's
6%
higher than
of them.
Is that higher than pain?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yes, it is. And but 6% of them were saying that they were feeling depressed, severely depressed. But the thing about this, Patrick, is these numbers match. That's a little bit higher, but these numbers match. Arizona did a study and found out 37% of gentlemen over the age of 25, I believe, were experiencing symptoms that would be indicative that they were feeling depressed, that they were clinically depressed and anxious.
So this is a trend. These kind of numbers are showing up. If I'm understanding you correctly, these kind of numbers are showing up in other studies. This is not an outlier study.
No, it's not. In fact, so, you know, when I decided to start the company, Mental Health Matters too, I went out and gave presentations. Then I realized how irresponsible that was to do presentations to raise awareness without getting resources together. So I put that on the website. But then I thought, I'm really shooting blind here. I need to figure out what the research is. And so that's the last thing I added to my website. It's a very small, it's 50 studies, but at least tells people, where they can go get more information for research.
That's a lot. Yeah, I mean, 50 studies for someone who's like a bit curious to learn more. I feel like that's going to get you started at least.
Yeah, in the right direction.
Before we wrap, Amy, is there any closing thought question that you would like to ask of Debbie just before we close out?
I just want to throw it again to Debbie to let everybody know about what work you're doing in an ongoing way to continue talking about this in communities across the country, because I know this isn't like just a one-off thing. You do a lot of work across the country, and where can people have access to you?
No, thank you. You can reach me at mentalhealthmatters2.com. And I put together a resource guide that helps people figure out how to get this stuff for free. One of the silver linings of the pandemic is that all of these organizations know where you had to pay for this stuff, like learning how to meditate for pain. Now it's free. It's the way to find it is called SoundTrue. But all of that information is on the website now. So it is that silver lining I see. And hopefully mental illness. Go ahead.
No, please. But hopefully mental illness.
What they're saying too is that hopefully this whole pandemic thing is going to destigmatize mental illness, mental health conditions, because now everyone kind of feels like what it's like to really feel depressed and anxious 24/7. You know, I don't mean like a mean twist, but it's true.
Yeah,
people can recognize this stuff is real.
And I'm really glad you made that point about the free resources that are being made available during this time. And that's great to know that Mental Health Matters too is a place people can go for where some of those have been aggregated. I didn't even think about that. And that feels like an opportunity to get for people who are interested in more information and are hungry for this kind of stuff, as I tend to be, that feels like a good opportunity not to miss.
Yeah, and I'm going to be definitely putting more resources since I know people might be going there.
Yes, people, that is the intention after all. Mental health matters too. So thank you again, Debbie, for today and for everything that you do to contribute to this, as well as, I know we can't say too much about it right now, but we have also been working together on a film about mental health and the bleeding disorders community that's going to be screening for the first time during the now virtual Bleeding Disorders Conference in August. This film has been in the works for a while, and Debbie has been an instrumental consultant and advisor on its content, its casting, its focuses. So keep eyes and ears out for that. And Debbie, again, thank you. And I hope you have a great, albeit probably quieter than usual, Memorial Day weekend.
This has been a lot of fun. You guys rock. Thanks for asking me on.
Thanks,
Debbie. A pleasure.
Alrighty.
Amy, just before we go, I wanted you to have a quick chance to let people know what's happening in the world of Ask the Expert of late.
Oh man, Ask the Expert is going to come out Monday, Memorial Day, with Dr. Valentino, NHF new brand spanking new CEO. We're going to have a great conversation with Dr. Valentino. He is very candid and lovely and speaks so eloquently about all things COVID, about all things research, how NHF is really taking this next era into a national research agenda, which is very interesting. It's very, I think, very encouraging where our national organization is going. I've been really impressed with him, as I've been impressed with HFA and the new leadership with Sharon Myers at HFA. So impressed with our two leaders. So back-to-back experts these last 2 months with our national organizations, which is cool.
Yes, the Sharon Myers episodes are out now. Sorry, go ahead.
Yes. So Sharon is out now, and her conversation is great. She's wonderful. I so enjoyed my conversation with her, and then Dr. Valentino. And then we've got good stuff coming up in June, too. So as the experts rolling.
Fantastic. We also did talk about the Pain Podcast, which I would highly recommend as well to anyone who found this conversation with Debbie interesting and is interested in the world of pain and mental health and how all that matrixes over with each other. So if you go to bloodstreammedia.com, you'll see the list of all of our podcasts, including what I guess now is the newest, Making Movies is Hard. It's the most entertainment forward of the entertainment health hybrid podcasts that you'll find from Bloodstream Media, but certainly something for film and television fans out there. A lot of great interviews, and there's like over 250 episodes, something like that. We adopted something that's been going for a while. So if you're interested in running out of things to listen to, bloodstreammedia.com, we're trying to make sure to keep you covered. Thank you, Debbie, for joining Amy and I here on Bloodstream to talk a bit about anxiety, depression, stress, and chronic pain. Before we wrap today, we will go through Debbie's meditation. I just first want to let you know that when the pod is over, you can visit Mental Health Matters 2, that's T-O-O, mentalhealthmatters2.com, if you're interested in the excellent resources that Debbie's made available over there. You'll also find Mental Health Matters 2 on Facebook, and you can find Debbie De La Riva on LinkedIn. Shout out to all the committed LinkedIn users in the audience. Debbie's article on mental health and the pandemic is in the August issue of L.A. Kelly Communications' Parent Empowerment Newsletter, or PEN, and keep an eye out for upcoming PTSD sessions that Debbie will be facilitating. The audio recorded live via Facebook on Friday isn't great for helping you experience the meditation here now. So I took the liberty of transcribing Debbie's meditation so that I could lead you through it here, fresh, with much, much better sound quality. After all, as something of an audiophile myself, I can think of little that would annoy me more than trying to meditate to some garbled audio. So, if you're interested and it's safe to do so, then after I remind you that this podcast was made possible by Takeda, who have a website called bleedingdisorders.com, and that subscribing to the Bloodstream podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever, and telling a friend about us is the quickest way to my heart, then after that, and if it's safe to do so, go ahead and bring your body to a place of rest. Check in with your breath and close your eyes. All meditations start the same. That is, simply close your eyes and get comfortable. And the idea is to simply, intentionally, bring on some relaxing breathing.
And what that involves is breathing in through your nose, filling the belly with air, then releasing that air through the mouth. Breathe in. One, two, three, four, and out. Two, three, four. Breathe in. Two, three, four. Breathe out. Two, three, four. A lot of people find it difficult to calm the mind, so it can be best to give it something to do, like breathe in colors. So as you're breathing and staying connected to your breath, become aware of your body, where your arms are. Are they touching a table or on a surface? Is there any tension in your face? Can you feel your feet on the ground? Can you feel the ground beneath your feet? The last thing that we'll do in this part of the meditation is remember a time that you felt comfortable and safe and happy. Really get in touch with that. Who was with you? Where were you? Are there any colors around you? Is it hot or cold? What's it smell like? And now, just for a few moments, stay in that place. Feel what it feels like to be safe and comfortable and confident. And as much as you might like to stay here, the point is, you can come back here anytime you'd like to. All you need to do is be intentional about how you want to deal with stress that day, or in that moment, even. Knowing that, and feeling a bit more safe, a bit calmer, slowly but surely, open your eyes. I hope you found that meditation helpful. This has been the Bloodstream Podcast. My name is Patrick James Lynch, and until next time, take self-care of yourself. Bye, everybody.